Moto, Kinichiro, Dozo. Moto Panakeku. Moto Panakeku. Moto Panakeku. Hai. Hai. Hai.
Episode number 44 of the Cut Print Film Podcast has the boys chatting and hair advice. Groovy, baby. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Internet, and all the little internets at sea.
At sea?
Yes, they're all at sea. Yeah. I'm Jeff Rollins.
I'm Dave Costell.
I'm Chris Evangelista.
And you're listening to the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 44.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
Yeah.
44 score ago.
We've been doing this for 44 years.
Yes.
We do a podcast every year.
You know, it's the perfect time to be a Cut Print Film listener.
Why? It sure is. Why don't you tell me more? Because I don't know where we're going with this.
Yeah.
Because today we're talking about Selma and Inherent Vice.
Ah, that's right. These are two great films to talk about.
And they are now playing everywhere. They were in limited runs before, but I believe as of last Friday, they are
limited edition.
Yeah.
Be dialing, everyone. So, we're going to be talking about Selma, which came out on Friday wide. Did this get released Christmas Day? Limited?
Very, very limited. I believe it was like three cities.
Okay, and Selma is directed by Ava DuVernay.
Yes.
And it's...
What has she done before? Anything?
She did a smaller film. They just added it to Netflix. I forget what it's called, though, because I'm bad at this.
This is her first major motion picture, and boy, is it ever major.
She's in Life Itself, the Roger Ebert documentary. She talks about how she met Roger Ebert when she was a kid. And
she looked familiar.
He, like, inspired her to make movies, and it's kind of cool that connection has come around.
Well, let me read the synopsis here, and then we'll get into Selma briefly.
Can you read it as a Martin Luther King speech?
I don't know if I have the gusto.
Yeah, I would rather you not do that.
How about I use my boring voice?
Yeah, use your plain voice.
So Selma chronicles the tumultuous three-month period in 1965 when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., led a dangerous campaign to secure equal voting rights in the face of violent opposition. The epic march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, culminated in President Lyndon B. Johnson, played by Tom Wilkinson in this, signing the Voting Rights Act of 1965, one of the most significant victories for the civil rights movement. Director Ava DuVernay's Selma tells the real story of how the revered leader and visionary Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., played by an amazing David Oyelowo.
He's really good in this.
Yeah. And his brothers and sisters in the movement prompted change that forever altered history. Now, this film is getting massive, massive critical praise and public praise.
Right, absolutely. And deservedly so, because it's a very good film.
Yeah.
This is one of those films I'd say, like, believe the hype.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Before it came out, we kept hearing all these critics who had seen it saying, oh, this is a great movie, and it was sort of like, sometimes when you hear that, you're like, I'll believe it when I see it. But
specifically when it's a biopic.
Right, yeah.
Because biopics tend to be atrocious. Especially when they try to span a person's entire life, and they just gloss over everything, so you get a jack of all trades, master of none type thing. But this film basically just focuses its camera on this one achievement that Martin Luther King was working on, and it's better for that.
It's similar to Spielberg's Lincoln in that instead of telling Lincoln's entire life, it just focuses on a specific point in his life.
Right.
The performance by David Oyelowo.
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 It's like saying, oh, yellow.
Oh, yellow. Oh, okay.
It's a good way to remember it.
Jesus Christ. I forgot what the real Martin Luther King looks like because he's just incredible. Transformed in my mind.
He embodies the role.
He really does.
I'd say he does a better job as Martin Luther King than Daniel Day-Lewis did as Lincoln.
As Martin Luther King. He's a terrible Martin Luther King, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Didn't believe him at all. Way too tall. And he was wearing that top hat the entire time. But yeah, I agree.
There's never a moment where I'm not buying it.
And I'm a Day-Lewis head, and I think
his
performance is far. Not that Day-Lewis is bad in Lincoln, but this I've never seen an actor just disappear into
Day-Lewis is horrible.
I've never seen an actor disappear into a real person before.
Where'd he go?
I'm just kidding. He's Martin Luther King, but he's really David Oyelowo.
But
I would say it's sort of a different sort of thing, though, because with Martin Luther King, we all have an idea of how he sounded and how he moved. With Lincoln, we don't really know that. We just have photos.
That's
so
true.
So I'd say it's like it's a different sort of thing. I think they both did a good job of bringing.
That's these true. Okay.
It's like they do a good job of bringing these historical people to life.
Let's give the point to Chris on that one.
Thanks, everyone.
And I will say this about Lincoln.
He's a bad president. So. No.
Incorrect.
I'm not voting for him this year.
His voice has always been portrayed as this stoic, deep voice, right. But there's actual recorded documents saying that he spoke in
MP3s.
No MP3s.
No, I believe they were dot waves.
Once again, everyone's incorrect. there's actual documentation stating that his voice was high,
right.
Just as Daniel Day-Lewis performed in that film. So yeah, he was probably accurate, but for a historical figure that we know what he sounds like and know what he looks like and know what his mannerisms were, like Martin Luther King, this is an incredible performance.
Yeah, I would say this is harder to do because with Lincoln, you can sort of wing it because no one will know if you're wrong or not. With this, you got to get it.
You can't put the footage side by side.
Yeah, exactly. There's not a lot of room for interpretation when you're playing Martin Luther King.
Yeah, and I think I'm not going to say he's a lock for a Best Actor nomination, but I'd be shocked if he weren't.
Who knows if he'll even get nominated with these crazy Oscars this year.
But even with this performance alone, you could have still had a bad movie.
Certainly.
But it just blew me away how beautiful and well-paced. And this movie hits every mark. It's gorgeous.
It does a really great job of just jumping from scene to scene and character to character. It never once feels
and trusting
like,
you to connect the dots.
Right.
It doesn't hold your hand.
Right. It never once feels like muddled or like I would compare it to in a negative way, like the film Crash, which won Best Picture, which also deals with racism with several different characters. And that movie's a mess.
Yeah, it just truly is.
All the characters are just they don't coalesce. Whereas this film, it all comes together.
Well,
perfectly.
The guy who wrote this, Paul Webb, has never written anything else.
That's really impressive.
That is incredible.
I just clicked on his name, and
this screenplay is airtight.
It's so tight.
It's amazing.
And not only is the screenplay really great, the Martin Luther King's estate wouldn't grant the filmmakers the rights to his speeches.
This is my favorite piece of trivia about this film.
Right, and so they had to make up Martin Luther King's speeches, and they sound accurate. It sounds exactly like
I was sleepy.
That's no.
Boy, they really nailed it. The thing about that is director Ava DuVernay, she was a double major at UCLA in English and African American Studies.
Okay.
And she wrote the speeches for this film. And
that's cool.
I don't know that I've ever heard a double major being put to such specific and excellent use.
It's like she went to school specifically to make this movie. Pretty much.
I just everything that I read about this film, like the making of this film, is so impressive to me and fascinating.
My favorite bit of trivia is originally Lee Daniels wanted to make this, and man, would that have been a terrible film. Lee Daniels, who directed Precious and The Butler.
Lee Daniels, The Selma.
A tone-deaf film that would have been.
Yeah, Lee Daniels, Selma, based on the novel Sapphire, whatever.
So, what were you going to say?
One second. It kind of, while watching the movie, not being able to use his speeches felt kind of like a travesty, like you took, because this is like a historical artifact.
It is weird that those speeches are so well protected. I don't really know I read that another film actually owned the rights to them.
Oh, really?
But,
is that what it is?
Yeah, so.
Oh, okay, because I was going to play devil's advocate and say that I can understand from his estate's point of view that how do they know that this film is going
it's
to gonna
be good?
Yeah. Good.
And
to grant them the permission to use these historical and history-changing speeches, and it end up being something really terrible like Pollock.
Or even, it's also because this film specifically does not deify Martin Luther King, which is another thing I really liked about it. It presents him
flawed.
As a flawed human person. He's not just like a larger-than-life, you know, character. He's an actual human. Like, this film highlights that he had like affairs and stuff like that, which is like historically documented, but people don't talk about it a lot.
And it's kind of weird because history belongs to the people, you know what I mean? So there should be able to be bad portrayals of his speeches.
You're right.
It's just like, yeah.
You can't just not have them at all because then the great ones don't get made, you know?
And then those speeches eventually
fade
into obscurity and are less important than they would have been. Right. So yeah, you're right. I guess the speeches should be allowed to appear in pop culture, good or bad.
Yeah.
But
they should be like a national property, not something that
I'd agree. Yeah,
yeah, that you're right.
Well, we solved that one. There you go. It's now official. It's now law.
I'll dump them back in.
All right, perfect.
Get to work on that.
I did want to say I wanted to talk about the controversy about the accuracy
that's
of
a big
President Lyndon B. Johnson and Martin Luther King's relationship.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a lot of, I would say, unwarranted controversy that's dogging this film as it gets closer to Oscar time. And there's been some rumors that it's like a deliberate thing to sort of just knock it out of the Oscar race, which is shameful if true.
That would be an absolute travesty. Right.
But that's how the game is played in Hollywood. It's all about it's Hollywood politics, basically.
I liked Tom Wilkinson's performance as LBJ.
I did too.
I liked how he didn't try to be LBJ at all. Like, it just kind of like,
it was a good performance. It did bother me a little bit how un-Southern he was, because LBJ had a very thick Southern accent.
Yes, he did. A very twangy speaking.
And yeah, Tom Wilkinson, he does an American accent because he's British, but he doesn't at once sound Southern. So it was like, you know, if you're going to be American, why not just go a little further and do the Southern accent?
It kind of made me wish that Tom Wilkinson was just our president and not LBJ.
Because
LBJ was a total dud of a president.
Tim Roth is in this. He's also English, and he does an excellent Southern accent.
Yes, he does.
Not like,
he, and he's a great villain in
he's
this.
He's very, he's really good in this movie.
Yeah, he's
as
he's
a despicable character.
Yeah. Like, so specifically, the controversy is that Martin Luther King in the film has to try and convince LBJ to allow him pass this voting act.
Right.
And he will not agree to it. So Martin Luther King back channels and organizes this march to from Selma to Montgomery. And they're saying in real life, LBJ was the one that actually suggested that. And he was all for this. And in the film, Tom Wilkinson portrays him as being, you know, flustered at it and kind of not pleased with the whole thing.
Honestly, I think that's probably how it happened, honestly.
It probably...
Yeah, what's the source there? LBJ in retrospect?
It's LBJ's, like, advisors are saying that. And it's like, of course they're going to say that.
I can't say yes or no. I have no idea. It's just me, Jeff Rollins here.
Yeah.
I have no insight to
Jeff
any
Rollins
of this.
With the movie news.
Well, no, we're not doing movie news.
It's people are looking at it with a modern sensibility. People have to realize this was the 60s, and as progressive as LBJ was, he still came up in a time.
He was a Southern man in 1965. Right. Do not tell me.
Yeah, don't tell me not once did he have problems with African Americans. Like, that's.
And I do like that they touch on the whole, well, I agree with you, we should do this voting act, but we can't do it right now, which I think is dog shit.
Right.
You can't meter out people's rights when it's convenient for you. So I loved that. I loved those scenes.
As I say in my review on cutprintfilm.com, our
website.
What's
that website again?
Cutprintfilm.com.
All right.
Is that an ad?
The movie makes a point of, like, I think the reason that Tim Roth's character in this film, what the hell is it? George Wallace. That's the character's name. I had a brief moment where I forgot it. The reason he's portrayed, he hates the whole idea of this.
And
LBJ's character, he's not against the idea. He just has to be talked into it. Because first and foremost, everyone has to remember that he was a politician. It's not like the president doesn't have unlimited power where he can just be like, I'm signing this into office. He had to convince Congress of that. And that the movie makes a point of pointing that out, that the reason he's so hesitant is because he realizes it's going to take a little more time.
Yeah.
And Martin Luther King's point is that it can't take any longer.
Right.
It needs to happen now.
The one criticism I will give this film is the Oprah part.
Not enough parkour.
Was a little distracting.
There's not enough parkour in the film.
Would you agree?
I certainly agree.
There are a few weird cameos in this film which sort of took me out of the movie. Like near the end, Martin Sheen pops up, and I was like, oh, I wasn't expecting it.
Cuba Gooding Jr. Shows up and said, remember me?
Right, and it was sort of...
And we said, nope, and then he disappears again.
It was sort of the same thing that 12 Years a Slave had with, because this is from the same production company, where it had all these big names popping up through the film.
Yeah.
And that sort of distracted
Brad
me, too.
Brad Pitt comes in, pulls the log cap.
Yeah, at the end, where he's just like, ah, I have this weird beard, and I'll save you all.
And then there's a terrible music choice towards the end, which almost ruins the movie for me. But
that really struck me as not recognizing that this should not be in there.
Yeah, and it's like, weird because the rest of the movie has great music in it.
Beautiful music. There's soul music. There's spirituals. Right. There's
music.
There's gospel music. It's fantastic. Yeah. And then this final.
It's like white.
It's like Creed light, yeah. Basically. Yeah.
It's this.
I don't even know what the song is. I couldn't find it anywhere on the internet.
No, because the only thing you can find is when you look up Selma soundtrack is that Common song.
Which plays over the credits, which is also not good.
It's
which
also
I did not care
a terrible
for.
Song.
Yeah.
But yeah, other than those final two music choices, and you know what? That's about it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed this movie so much.
It's an excellent film.
And I'd be absolutely stunned if this didn't do well at the Oscars,
it's
nominated.
It seems like the Oscar race has been narrowed down to either this or Boyhood.
Yeah.
And I would say this 100%
over
Boyhood.
Oh, every single time. 10 out of 10 times, yeah. I would say Selma, please.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind this winning Best Picture at all.
No. It probably won't, though, because the Oscars are bullshit.
Speaking of getting high and solving crime.
Wow.
That was a great segue.
That was like shaving with an old razor. I didn't enjoy it at all.
Paul Thomas Anderson's Inherent Vice came out.
Yes.
That was at Christmas, too,
a little
before.
That was also at
December
Christmas.
December 12th, yeah. I want to say the date was for that.
Chris and I saw it at a screening
right.
together
yeah.
about a month ago.
Back in
we
October.
Held hands.
Yes, we did. And we were both on either end of the theater, which made it very strange.
It's very weird how we could do that.
Do you guys even remember the movie? That was so long ago.
Yes, I do.
I also remember there was a lunatic in the theater with us who
certainly was.
Who laughed like the Crypt Keeper at every scene.
I felt terrible for the people sitting around him.
But we won't talk about him too much.
He was cackling like a madman.
I think he's deranged. But anyway.
So I have a plot synopsis for Inherent Vice.
Oh, my God.
I hope it's really muddled and weird like
the
film.
Nope, it's not at all.
Okay.
I kept this as succinct as possible.
Good work.
It's a Costas cake.
Yeah. Sweet. So Inherent Vice is an adaptation of Thomas Pynchon's novel of the same name, and it stars Joaquin Phoenix, Josh Brolin, Catherine Waterston, Owen Wilson, Joanna Newsom, and a host of other people.
Yes, big cast.
It is the seventh film by Paul Thomas Anderson and the first ever adaptation of Thomas Pynchon.
Right.
The plot goes a little something like this. When Private Eye Doc Sportello's ex-old lady suddenly out of nowhere shows up with a story about her current billionaire land developer boyfriend whom she just happens to be in love with, and a plot by his wife and her boyfriend to kidnap that billionaire and throw him in a loony bin. It's 1970, and paranoia is running the day, and Doc knows that love is another of these words going around at the moment like trip or groovy that's being way too overused, except this one usually leads to trouble. With a cast of characters that includes surfers, hustlers, dopers, rockers, a murderous loan shark, LAPD detectives, a tenor sax player working undercover as a snitch, and a mysterious entity known as the Golden Fang, which may only be a tax dodge set up by some dentists. Part surf noir, part psychedelic romp, all Thomas Pynchon. And that's all I'm saying about the plot of Inherent Vice,
yes.
Because the plot really doesn't matter.
Yeah,
this
is
film.
Yeah, this is a film where it doesn't. I've seen a lot of reviews. They criticize the film because it's like, I can't follow it, and that's not the point of this movie.
No, it's not. It's also not the point of the novel because the novel is just as convoluted.
Right.
Yeah, it's very dense. Right. I would say in terms of terms and names and stuff.
Yeah,
there's these wild names.
Right. Deliberately goofy names.
Coy Harlingen, Shasta Faye Hepworth,
right.
Doc Sportello,
right.
Bigfoot Bjornsson, another one.
So what did everyone think of Inherent Vice?
I'm going to let Dave start this one.
Yeah, well, I have trouble criticizing Paul Thomas Anderson because I put him in that...
His breath stinks.
That hierarchy of... God, like, he's in the pantheon of directors with Scorsese and Kubrick.
Yeah.
So it's tough to like, pick apart his movie because you know you're not smart enough to do it. So... But my initial reaction was almost the same as The Master when I stepped out, where I was like... yeah, that was good, but I didn't love it as much as I thought I did. Then the next day I woke up and realized I couldn't stop thinking about the movie.
Yeah.
And then I started watching it again at home, and it's just incredible.
Like, it really is.
Like, there's so much going on in every scene. Like, in the background, you would have to watch this movie like 20 times to get it all.
Yeah.
Most definitely. Did anybody else read the novel?
I did not. Okay. I have trouble with Pynchon's writing.
As do I.
I'm not smart enough, I guess.
I will argue that you are smart enough, and I feel that I'm smart enough. I hate Pynchon's writing. I hate it. And I did not like this novel at all. All the humor, because this is Paul Thomas Anderson's funniest film by far.
It's hysterical.
It is a comedy,
right?
Above all. And those same jokes that are in the film are also in the novel, but I just read it stone-faced. None of it really translated on the written page, for me, at least.
Well, yeah, I could see that, because, like, Josh Brolin, his character, could be read as not funny. Like, it's all in the performance and the timing and how it's shown, you know what I mean? Like, the way you're seeing him eat this fucking plate of weed is it's hilarious. But if I was reading that, I would be like,
It's written as just matter of fact, and maybe I just don't get that type of humor when it's written for me. I have to see it performed with tones, different voice tones and stuff like that, inflections.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna say we're just idiots, because Thomas Pynchon's considered the greatest post-World War II American author.
I know he is. I'm not a fan of his work. I also don't like David Foster Wallace, and he's also highly revered.
Yeah.
But enough about books.
Who likes books?
Gravity's Rainbow, everybody.
Not long enough, I say. So going into this, before I saw the trailer, I thought, well, I'm not really excited, even though I'm a huge Paul Thomas Anderson fan. Once I saw the trailer, my excitement was ramped up exponentially. And then walking out of the film, I thought, wow, that was hilarious. That was really good. But that was not my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson film. And like you, I thought about it constantly, over and over. And it's still not my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson film, but it's certainly not his worst film. It's somewhere in the middle for me, between... Somewhere between There Will Be Blood and Heart 8 is where that lies.
you really narrowed it down.
Yes.
But no, I mean directly in the middle. Oh, yeah, okay. Directly in the middle.
This movie, which is what makes it different than all of Paul Thomas Anderson's movies, it's so overtly funny. It's a comedy.
Right. I mean, because all of his movies have humor in them. Even There Will Be Blood, which is dark, has humor.
Yeah.
But this is deliberately like a laugh out loud funny movie.
I'd say this is a combination, if we're just comparing his work, it's a combination of Boogie Nights and Punch Drunk Love.
Right.
Those are the two closest films if you were to combine them.
Yeah.
That's kind of the tone. You got the absurd humor of Punch Drunk Love, where Adam Sandler just punches everything in a bathroom. Like, stuff like that. These nonsensical events that happen. And you also have, you know, the funny dialogue of Boogie Nights, where people are just saying outlandish things.
Right, and then the period setting and all that sort of thing.
But it doesn't have any of the dread that Boogie Nights has.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, there's tension, but it's
it's not
almost,
like,
it's almost immediately relieved.
Yeah, you don't,
you're never worried about any of
the
characters.
No one's going to really be in danger, even though people are in danger. I mean, it's never like, but I will say this film has a, it's very melancholy, which I was not expecting. It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot more somber and even depressing than I thought it would be, which I loved because I wasn't expecting that. It worked so well.
Yeah. I mean, it's about these people. The whole film's filmed through a drug haze.
Right.
The entire thing. It's this underworld of, I guess you would call them former hippies, because it takes place in 1970, which is right after the Summer of Love. So you got the Manson murders heavily looming over this entire thing.
Yeah.
And everybody's paranoid about hippies. They don't trust them. And
the moon. No, it has nothing to do with this.
I don't understand where we're going.
Yeah, no.
You just drove a stake through the heart of my whole topic.
Please, Jeff, continue.
So yeah, this Doc Sportello, he is a, I'm going to say, strung out private investigator who has his own office, which is inside a gynecologist's office. That's why he's called Doc.
Right.
And but he's even though he's in this drug-induced haze for most of the film, and we're seeing things that might not even be happening through his eyes, he is in search of the truth. Like, he really is a private investigator. He cares about finding the truth. And when his ex-lover comes to him with this crazy plot, he loves her and he wants to get to the bottom of this for her. So I guess he's in search of the truth and true love, because this she is his true love.
And in the movie, it's sort of like it's basically this character, Joaquin Phoenix's character, reacting to just the unfulfillment of the promises of the 60s. Like, the 60s are over, and the 70s have just become this sort of dire time. And it's sort of like this character is just, he wants that sort of like that free love feeling back. Yeah. And that's what his ex-girlfriend represents to him. And he's always just chasing that feeling. And she's like, this is a great performance by Catherine Waterson.
Yes, it is.
She's fucking fantastic in this. And she basically represents like this ideology that he's just chasing after. And that's why he's just so hung up on her.
And yet, it's just a carrot on a stick. She's not real. Free love, it's false. It's not real. I mean, he's looking for it through her.
Yeah.
But even she has kind of, you know, what's he say when she shows up? You're dressed
in a new package or something?
No, he makes this reference to what he calls the people on the outside of the world they live in, and she's dressed, you know,
very
properly.
Conservative. Yeah. You would, yeah.
And you kind of get the feeling like, well, maybe that's who she actually is.
Right. But then she shows up at the end and she's dressed like she used to be. And there's a great scene. It's probably like one of my favorite scenes in any movie ever. It's a flashback scene to where there's like a pot shortage where everyone's like, they can't find pot. And so Joaquin Phoenix's character, Catherine Waterson's character, and Joanna Newsom's character, they're sitting around, they use a Ouija board basically to try and find pot.
Yeah.
And it leads them to like an address, and so Joaquin Phoenix's character and Catherine Waterson, they run out, and this like sun shower, it's like sunny but it's raining, and this Neil Young song is playing, and it's just this lovely, sad,
it's beautiful.
It's a gorgeous. It almost like took my breath away. This scene, just how well it perfectly,
it's like in the doorway of a laundromat.
Yeah, it perfectly encapsulates that. Like nostalgic feeling you get for like an ex-girlfriend you're like hung up. I feel like everyone has that ex-girlfriend or boyfriend that even if they're happy now in their life, they still have that one person from their past they just think about. And it's like, I still think about them from time to time.
Even if it's a false memory.
Right.
Even if it's an embellished memory.
Right.
It's funny because that is similar to the scene in Blue Valentine when he's playing the ukulele. It's
right,
like,
yeah,
it takes
in the
place
doorway.
In the same kind of doorway.
Yeah.
And has the same kind of vibe. But it's weird how you said, like, it's not real. Like, how much of this is real? Because then later, you see Doc walking by that same thing, and the wall ends, and then the Golden Fang office is right there. Right.
Ugly modern architecture is there.
And I wanted to touch on that about what's real and what's not real in this film, starting with that Joanna Newsom character,
right.
Sword of Edge. She's not in the book. And I don't think she's in the movie either. I don't think she's a real person. She narrates this entire film, and she comes and goes out of the same scene. She'll be driving with, you brought this up to me, Dave. She'll be driving with Joaquin Phoenix and they're talking together, and then the camera pans to the other side of the car and she's not in the car anymore.
Yeah. I don't think she's there.
I don't think she exists in this film, and her name is Sword of Edge. And that's a French method of casting spells and foretelling the future by sorting random items pulled out of a bag, which is exactly what this film is. It's just random scenes, which is something Paul Thomas Anderson is fantastic at, filming big epic scenes and then piecing them together with, you know, appropriate segues. And that represents this film perfectly. So I think that was an amazing way to frame this entire film through the narration of Sword of Edge.
Yeah, I mean,
plopping her into various scenes.
That's the genius of Paul Thomas Anderson, though, because he wrote that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it works so well. And Joanna Newsom is such a vital part of this movie.
Right. She keeps the film flowing.
And that she doesn't exist, and that they don't harp on the fact that she doesn't exist, is just masterful.
I think she exists as a person in the film. I don't think she's really popping up. I think like he's imagining that. I think she exists only because at the end of the film, Catherine Waterson's character mentions her character. And so if you're saying Joanna Newsom's character is not real, you have to say that Catherine Waters is not real either, and I think that opens up a whole can of worms.
But I don't think she is. Like, the improbability that all of these things are connected to Shasta Fey is, like...
I agree.
It's absurd.
It does open up a can of worms, but I like the can of worms right here, and I brought three forks, and I want to salt it again.
I had worms for breakfast, so... I think there's no wrong answer. No, let me put it like that.
Yeah. I agree.
And I love
it's one of those things that it avoids being figured out. It doesn't.
It's also
no end to it.
It's also, I think, a kind of a weird callback to a film. This film keeps getting compared to is The Big Lebowski, because Sam Elliott's character in that film is exactly the same thing, where he just pops into scenes and he also narrates the movie. And I wonder if that was just like a subconscious thing that Paul Thomas Anderson didn't realize he was actually. I'm not going to say ripping off, but sort of paying homage to.
Well, it's tough because Big Lebowski is Pynchon. You know what I mean? Like they took The Crying a Lot 49 and this... they didn't take this because
this came out after Big Lebowski.
But The Crying a Lot 49 is very similar to this, too.
I mean, you could compare this to The Long Goodbye and Altman's Chinatown and a host of other, you know, tightly intertwined plots that we've seen through cinema over the decades. But I don't know. There's something about this that is, even though it's set in 1970, it's so 2014.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the way he filmed it or
it
if
might
it's just...
be like Pynchon wrote this in 2009. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like a lament of, like you
I
were
think
saying.
That's it. I think you're, that's it.
So it has a modern vibe to it.
It's kind of like, Grand Budapest Hotel, how that movie is all about wanting a different time that's already gone. At the end of Grand Budapest Hotel, there's this whole exchange between F. Murray Abraham's character and Jude Law, where he's like, oh, did you keep the hotel running to, you know, be in his time? And where he finds character Simon.
Yeah.
And F. Murray Abraham says, you know, I think his time had already passed before he even got to it.
Right.
And that's sort of what this is, too. It's just, it's someone writing now, 21st century, reflecting on the 70s reflecting on the 60s. It's just like it's reflecting on a time that is already gone, basically.
That's how interesting that 2014 is bookended by two films with that exact same theme.
Yeah.
And they're both two of the best films of the year.
Absolutely.
That's kind of
so get writing on that one.
Kind of strange.
Yeah.
Yes. And all you writers out there, I just give you a great thesis.
Yeah. And if you want to, send it to us at Cut Print Film. Do you guys want to take a break? We'll come back, talk more?
Yeah, because we need to talk a lot more about this.
And I have to bring out another can of worms.
Okay. Don't!
Oh.
We haven't finished this one.
I'll be surfing out of here.
Shh. What? Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of CutPrintFilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
Cutprint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do. It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Lemons.
Don't know much about history.
Yeah.
Don't know much biology.
Tell him, Sam.
Don't know much.
Hey, something's wrong with this recording. There's an asshole interrupting Sam Cooke.
Don't know much about cinematography.
All right.
Don't know much about directing films.
Well, I think you're at the wrong podcast.
It was a. I have no words for what just happened.
I do. Garbage. Shit.
I have one word. Don't.
Hey, welcome back to the Cut Print Film Podcast.
That's right.
We're discussing Paul Thomas Anderson's 2014 film, Inherent Vice.
Yeah, it's now playing everywhere. Go out and see it.
Please.
In IMAX 3D.
Wait a second. No, if you're lucky, you can see this in 35mm.
Yes.
But none of you will.
No, because
how would that happen?
You'd have to... Well, there were private screenings in New York and LA.
You have to live in a good city where they care about such things.
Like Cleveland, Ohio.
Well...
Where you can catch this film when it gets released in 2019.
Or Boise, Idaho.
Mm-mm. Oh boy, I'm in Boise.
Since we're on the topic, would you agree, and this might be premature because I haven't spent enough time with it, but this is like Paul Thomas Anderson's most gorgeous movie.
It looks incredible.
It has great cinematography.
I don't know if I would say it's better looking than There Will Be Blood, because I really do love the way that looks. And I also love the way The Master looks.
The Master looks gorgeous, because he shot that on, I think he shot it on 70mm.
Yeah, and that's why when you said like it's somewhere between There Will Be Blood and Hard Eight, like I would put this There Will Be Blood, The Master, Inherent Vice, just because those three films are so like, there's something sutured through them that makes them feel similar. It's the California thing, but at the same time, it's just that grainy, beautiful, like, callback to old cinema.
Yeah. I would say this is one of his most cinematic films.
It's absolutely so colorful.
Yeah.
It is. The colors explode. And, I mean, the color of the cover of the book when it first came out was just as colorful. Right. So, I mean, that was clearly Pynchon's goal in writing the book, is to create this bright, vibrant world, which really didn't translate to me, as I said, but some people loved it, and Paul Thomas Anderson got it and was able to make one hell of a film.
But there's something about that brightness that like adds to the melancholy of it, because it's like he's still unfulfilled even in this like daisies popping up world.
It's like it's deceptive. It's a deceptive brightness, because at the end of the film, it's still,
it's like a shiny veneer, you know, on shit, essentially.
Yeah, you're right. That's shellacked poop.
That's a good way to put it.
Thank you.
That's
everyone.
Your pull quote right there.
So I wanted to talk about some of the characters and performances that we haven't discussed. I mean, we've talked about, you know, the direction and the way
I don't
the film
think we
looks.
Talked about any. We haven't talked about Joaquin Phoenix at all, have we?
Not one lick.
Oh, is he in this movie?
Yes, he is. He stars in this as Doc Sportello. That's Dr. Sportello.
Which is strange, because, like, he's so fucking good, but
He's great, but I feel like, I'm not going to say he gets dwarfed by the KS. I just feel like everyone else is so, he's sort of like the straight man, I think.
Yes, he's the anchor of this film.
Like, even though he is very funny in the film, everyone else is insanely outrageous, so he sort of gets, not forgotten, but he sort of gets like, you know, pushed aside.
He gets his zany antics in when he's huffing laughing gas, right, and he's sitting relaxing in his office in gynecological stirrups.
Yeah.
That got a big laugh out of the audience.
I don't know, everything that I really heartily laughed at, I think, was Joaquin Phoenix.
Hey, there's that great bit where he screams at the picture.
Right. Jesus Christ, that. Still, like, thinking about it,
it's funny. It's so funny.
Right. You know, conjures a laugh out of me. Just think, it's so out of nowhere and just over the top that it killed me.
It's a great performance of reactions, I think. Because basically, the whole movie is Doc reacting to everything that's happening.
Yes, this lunacy surrounding him.
And Joaquin Phoenix does a lot of great stuff, just with, like, his eyebrows and stuff. Just, like, arching his eyebrows at the ridiculousness that's going on around him.
Yeah, this film, it's pretty much faced the movie. Everybody's face is
very tight,
taking up the entire screen. And not just Joaquin Phoenix, everyone.
Right, yeah.
Anderson does that too. But Phoenix especially, he is so expressive in he was really expressive in The Master.
Yeah.
Like, and I mean really expressive in The Master.
But those were different expressions.
Yeah, and the fact that he's that talented that he can create this entire different person just with facial tics is so impressive.
I've said this before, but I do think he's probably one of the best working actors today.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
I think I would say the best working
actor. I don't know
actor.
If I'd say the best, but he's definitely up there. But let's not split hairs.
Yes.
But to counter what you said,
conditioner for these split ends.
To counter what you said, the person I laughed at the most in this film is Josh Brolin, because I'm not going to say he steals the film, but he's
almost.
He's so good in it. He's hilarious.
In it's pretty much a reversal of the straight man and the foil.
Right.
And I think that's why it works so well when Josh Brolin, this man is square defined.
Even his hair is square.
Yes, he has this box cut hair, and his
name's Bigfoot.
His name's Bigfoot Bjornsson, and he's an aspiring actor, which means he comes from the world that Doc wants no part of. But he wants to break into the world that Doc is a part of, and yet he resents it at the same time. So they both resent one another, and yet they represent...
And Doc's doing his job,
right,
but on a different level.
They represent the two worlds trying to escape into one another,
right,
and it really, really works. especially with just the zaniness of this Bigfoot Bjornsson. The things that he does.
He loves frozen bananas, which got to laugh every single time.
He is making love to these bananas with his mouth, and it's so funny because he's this hulking character that you just don't expect behavior like this to come out of. Like you mentioned, when he eats this entire plate of marijuana,
I don't know why
he's doing it.
There's this whole ending sequence where he kicks a fucking door in and comes in, and it's probably one of the funniest things. I laughed hysterically during this. It was insane because not only is it funny, it's like weirdly touching. Where Doc and Bigfoot, they have this sort of like moment where they realize they are like friends in a weird way. Yeah. It's just.
Yeah, how do you read that character? Because some of the things I was reading about him were saying that he's a villain, and I don't see him as a villain at all.
He's like a foil. He's not a villain. He just does things that hinder Doc. Like at the beginning, you find out he more or less set Doc up for that whole murder at the beginning, more or less, where the guy gets killed at the massage parlor.
But like he didn't charge him for it, and he's very like, I don't know. It seems like he wants to be Doc's friend, but doesn't want to admit it.
He wants to be Doc. He wants to be this sort of like carefree stoner guy, and he can't be
right.
That
even at home, his wife
that
rules
scene
the roost.
Is fucking awesome,
and it comes out of nowhere where his wife is just henpecking him and telling him, "No, this is how it's going to be."
Right? Yeah.
And then he's like, "I don't know. He called me.
Yeah,
fucking killed me."
You're led to believe that this character is in charge of everything, and it turns out that. Yeah. I mean, and that's why he wants to break into this carefree world that Doc exists in. But Josh Brolin is fantastic. Joaquin Phoenix is really just a master class he's delivering here. I wanted to talk about some of the ancillary characters.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
There are.
The whole movie is sort of ancillary characters.
I'd like to start with Owen Wilson.
Okay.
What did you guys think of this performance?
It was Owen Wilson. I don't think I saw.
Yeah,
him.
I'd say if I had to pick a weak spot, not even weak because I don't think it was a bad performance. It wasn't as captivating. Like I feel like someone better could have done it.
I mean, that said, who else would you want playing your surf band saxophonist other than a man like Owen Wilson?
Yeah, he didn't bother me.
The only other person that pops to my head, like imagine if like Matthew McConaughey played that character, like that would have been like knocked out of the park.
Yeah, probably.
Or even like Woody Harrelson, like either one of those guys, because they both work well in that.
You know what? Woody Harrelson would have been a perfect casting choice. Wilson worked for me because there's not too much of him in this film.
Yeah, there's not a lot.
And like you said, he is Owen Wilson. He's playing Owen Wilson, but sometimes I like that, and I liked it in this film.
Yeah,
he plays a. Like I said, a surf band saxophonist who's also an FBI snitch.
Yeah.
Do you think that could have been Philip Seymour Hoffman's part?
No.
I don't picture that.
Okay. Because I'm thinking of Boogie Nights, like that, that wackiness.
Yeah,
in that character.
They're such different sort of things.
Moving on from Owen Wilson.
There was Michael K. Williams was in this.
Yeah, very briefly. I really could have used...
More
Michael K. Williams than anything, really. But
Jenna Malone is in one scene.
She's in two. She's at the end, too.
She's got two scenes, and she's great. She delivers a monologue. It's really nice.
She's got these big fake teeth.
And I was so distracted by them, thinking, is it just me, or does something look incredibly wrong here?
Yeah.
And then she addresses that they are porcelain, if I'm not mistaken.
And then speaking of teeth, we have... the seed-stealing, not cameo, but performance by Martin Short, who is very good in this.
Martin Short's performance in this film as this dentist who's the head of the Golden Fang, which I still don't know what the Golden Fang is.
It's several things. It's like a...
It's a tax shelter.
It's a boat.
It's also an opium den of some sort.
It's a million different things. But Martin Short's character is Dr. Rudy Blatnoid, DDS.
My goodness, is this character funny. He's just a madman.
Yeah, he's like a degenerate dentist, basically.
He's snorting rails of cocaine off his desk.
When he comes back and he's like, look at the greedy little hippies. Yeah. He just has these like killer lines, and he's so manic and like sweating.
Yeah, he's having like a running affair with a almost underage patient, basically. Yeah.
He's wearing this like
velvety
red velvet suit.
Yeah. It's a great performance because Martin Short's one of those actors I just like forgot about because he hasn't done anything that I wanted to see in a long, long time. Not even Jiminy Glick, which is terrible.
Boy.
But he's great in this, and it's a great little performance.
Yeah, and there's something that his character ends up being involved in a trampoline accident of some sort. And these are all the things you can see in Inherent Vice.
There's another great performance that I really like in this film is Martin Donovan as the guy at the end. He shows that he's like the lawyer character. He's the father of the daughter that...
Whose name is
Jaconic. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And because he's
what
a character.
Was he in?
He was in Weeds, season 2 of Weeds. He played a DEA agent.
Oh, that's what it is. Yeah, okay.
And he was excellent in that. He's the one character who was interesting at all in that show.
Right. His name in the movie is Crocker Fenway.
Just such a normal name.
my firstborn son would be named Crocker Fenway Rollins.
And what I liked about this performance is because through the whole movie, they keep talking about his character. And he shows up at the end and... It's a very, because a lot of the performances in this film are very showy and manic, and he's like the one reserved character.
And boy, does he not have any time for nonsense.
Yeah, and like you get this sense of how like dangerous he is and how like easily he can just have people killed. And that really kind of impressed me that he just shows up at the end and it has this like aura of like in chargeness that no one else in the film has.
Yeah. No, he has all his ducks in a row, they say.
There's a good exchange in that scene which highlights one of the more subversive themes of like anti-capitalism in the film when he's like, he's offering Doc money, but instead he just wants to save Owen Wilson's character.
Yeah.
But then later he's like, Doc says something like, how much money would I have to take for to not lose your respect?
Yeah.
And the guy says it's too late for that. And in that moment, you kind of realize that Doc has been working this whole movie and outright refusing to take any money from people.
Right.
He's pretty much uncorruptible.
Yeah.
Except when it comes to Catherine Waterston's Shasta Fey, where she, you know, as we
has
talked
power
about.
Over him.
Yeah, she is the carrot on the stick in front of him. And in the end, she once again ropes him in.
Right.
And
let's,
you get that tragic scene. Did you want
to? Let's just talk more about her, this character and this performance.
Okay.
I don't know, I would say like this is a
well. She's barely in the movie.
But she makes such a fucking impression. I can't remember the last time an actress or actor came out of nowhere like this and just wowed me so much with the performance. It's such a.
I thought for sure I had seen this woman in things before, and no, not one film have I seen her in before this.
She's
and yet,
has he explained where he found her? He just casting.
I don't know. I mean, she's Sam Waterston's daughter. That's all I know. So
she's really good in this.
It's just she has this. There's this intense sequence near the end of the film. It's like it never cuts. It's like one long.
It's about 5 minutes long.
Yeah, there's a long monologue where she undresses and it's just
seduces Doc.
Yeah, and I can't even do it justice just talking. You have to like see it to believe it. But it's such this incredible.
It's powerful and it's erotic
and it's sad. It's just because
it's hypnotic. Almost.
Like
it is hypnotic.
Like while he's listening to this, like you see him like shed like a tear as he's listening to her thing, and then she like climbs on his lap, and like I could feel how uncomfortable the audience was we were with watching it, and then it results in her like him like spanking her, and like it feel like it's like this weird release of the scene, and it's just
you're absolutely right,
and it's just
that might be one of Paul Thomas Anderson's best scenes.
It's so well done and well created, and it is hypnotic. It's just like you get into like a trance. Like I'm sure I did, but I felt like I didn't blink during that entire sequence.
Same here.
It just blew me away. And
she was rubbing her nipple. I mean,
that's the only reason. Yeah. The whole scene, I was licking my lips and rubbing my hands together like a Tex Avery cartoon.
That's insane because you've said that this contains maybe your favorite scene of all time in movies.
Yeah.
And Jeff just said his favorite Paul Thomas Anderson scene.
It's one of
scene,
my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson scenes.
And, but like, what makes.
And it's also, you know, not to interrupt, but.
No.
As sad as it is one of the sexiest things
oh my God.
Ever seen in a film.
Yeah, and it was great.
And
like true sexy, like actual sexuality on the screen.
But then it's like completely undone at the end because she says something like, this doesn't mean we're back together.
Right,
so
it
unwraps itself quickly.
It's hard to convey sexiness in a movie because it's
just
acting.
Put me on the screen.
Yeah, well, I don't think the silver screen's ready to handle all that sexiness.
We'll have to settle for the bronze screen.
Is that YouTube?
It's Vimeo, I believe. But it's because it's, you know, it's acting, and some actresses, even if they're sexy, they can't convey
it's hard.
Sexiness, you
it's
know?
It's a hard thing to accurately portray.
Like, I would say, like, an actress comes to mind is, like, Jessica Alba, who is sexy, but she's, like,
not
you watch her
on
film, it's
not.
Like, oh, this is like watching a dead fish. Like, where you watch
things just sexless.
Yeah. Yeah. But
and,
this
and that also has a lot to do with the director.
Right.
So,
and it's just, it's such a good performance. I can't get over this performance. Like, yeah. I can't wait to see what this actress does next, honestly.
That said, I feel like a lot of the other women in this film are not great characters. They're kind of flat and one-dimensional.
Yeah.
Really?
Reese Witherspoon.
Okay.
Specifically.
I felt like her character was useless, honestly.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't say useless because I really like that scene where they're just like hanging out.
Right. That's when she becomes a real character.
I like that scene, but it just felt like, that's in our case, like a better actress could have done it better.
Yeah. And the scene
she's
where
she's playing a type. She's just playing a type. Yeah. She's this, is she FBI?
She's a DA.
Okay. She's a district attorney and she's just playing a lawyer.
Right.
A straight lawyer.
She's like Ally McBeal.
And it's a bore. And it's unbelievable. I don't know. It just didn't do anything.
It didn't take
me
out of it.
I did like the actress's name is Hong Chow as Jade. I thought that was a very funny
performance. That was funny.
Right.
But again, it's a very one-dimensional character.
Yeah, I would agree, but it's a funny one-dimensional character.
It is.
So, whereas Reese Witherspoon's character, it's one-dimensional and there's not anything else to it. It's not a funny character. So
I'd argue there's not much to... What was her name? Jade?
Yeah.
The character?
Yeah, but she's funny. Like those scenes where he goes into the chick massage place.
Chick Planet or something it's called.
It's hilarious.
And he's like, oh, the Pussy Eater Special. And then they kind of like start eating each other out and go off camera down. And like he tries to get in on it.
Yeah.
And they tell him, oh, he's not part of this. And he like looks at the menu.
The
and he's like, oh, it says right here, the Pussy
and
Eater
just
Special.
Staggers away. Yeah.
And it's also
great scene.
Jenna Malone, I mean, she did a great job,
right.
But again, that character is just drug addict.
Yeah.
I kind of love that this movie's full of women though. Like it,
I did too. I
wish there was more to them.
I would have liked if they did a lot more with the characters.
Yeah.
And I know this is based on a previous written work. I get that.
Right.
I understand that this is not Anderson's fault
or
these actresses' fault, but I just would have preferred, you know, female characters with more to do.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I don't think they're useless characters. I just feel like they're not.
Like, look how complex Bigfoot Bjornsson is.
Oh,
he's not the star of the film.
Absolutely.
And even Owen Wilson's character, Cooey Harlingen, he's complex.
Yeah, I would agree with
that. He's got to wear several different hats.
Yeah.
And he's, I mean.
Yeah, that. The scene where they go to kind of like that acid party.
I love
that.
That
was
scene,
a great scene.
And that,
where
Owen
Wilson
weird,
is good in that scene.
And there's that like weird Last Supper recreation, which I loved.
I love that shot.
Yeah.
Man, that was a good shot.
Yeah.
So that scene specifically touches on those themes of like you were saying. I don't know why though, but it made me like when they're walking into the party and up to the movie to this point, it's very 70s, and it made me kind of like wish I could be a part of that. Like,
oh yeah, I wanted
like,
to be the,
if
at
I could
that
just
party.
Fucking throw this smartphone out. And it's just like a totally different world that we're never going to.
Oh yeah, it'll never
to be
happen
part
again.
Of.
Yeah.
Right.
And that like made me so sad.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Then I think the film did the job. Because,
yeah.
It's
like
this
Chris
confluence
said,
of emotion.
Yeah. It's that melancholy that was also present in Grand Budapest.
It's such a unique sort of movie. Like I can't. There aren't a lot of movies like. I think this is like. This is one of the things that's destined to be like a cult classic because I feel like a lot of the reaction to this film, not from critics, just from people, it's like they're not quite getting what the hell this movie is about.
It's holding a 68% on Rotten Tomatoes, right. Which is, I think, Anderson's lowest ranked film.
Because like,
really?
It was marketed as this silly comedy, which it is, but it's so much more than that. And I feel like people went into this expecting wacky, fun comedy, and they weren't expecting something so complex.
This is a great movie, and I think it's going to end up being, like you said, kind of forgotten,
right.
But still appreciated and spoken of as a great movie. Sort of like Barry Lyndon by Stanley Kubrick, which we're going to be talking about next week.
Yes.
I think this kind of ties in perfectly with that, because that is one of his least talked about films, and yet it's got nothing but accolades critically, and it won Oscars for all these technical achievements. And I feel like these are one and the same as far as that goes. They're lesser appreciated works, but they're masterpieces regardless.
I'm hoping this is more of a Space Odyssey where it was like, you know, not appreciated at its time, but people realize later that it's a fucking masterpiece.
I would say I would bring this again back to Big Lebowski, how when that came out, it got no reaction. Yeah. And then over time, it built up this weird cult following where it's like ingrained into our culture. And I could see that happening with this movie.
Yeah, but that, I think that has more to do with like a frat boy culture of people who love to quote movies and watch movies.
I guess, but like, I feel like that movie's better than that culture. I feel like...
It definitely is, but I can't see this movie touching, like, tapping into
it's
that.
It's too dense.
It'll never reach that level where, you know, fucking Hot Topic is selling t-shirts for it, but I feel like it's in that same sort of ballpark where it's going to be a film, like, I would say 5 years from now where it's people are going to be quoting it sort of like Big Lebowski, but not as much. I think it's going to get rediscovered is basically what I'm saying.
I hope it does.
I hope so too, because it deserves it. It deserves...
I hope I'm wrong is what I'm saying. I hope it's not relegated to the...
I always hope you're wrong.
Yeah, what's our secret hope?
Well, I don't know why all this animosity is coming out.
Oh, we didn't even talk about Benicio Del Toro, who plays a pretty big role in the film.
I felt like that character was kind of wasted, honestly.
Yeah. And I felt like those scenes went on too long with him. The one, especially when they're at the restaurant and they just keep talking. And
I had a hard time following that scene. I think it's just because they're whispering and they're saying a lot of weird things.
It's tough for me because I always like seeing Benicio Del Toro on screen.
Yeah.
And yet it's generally a disappointing outing whenever I see him.
There's a lot of whispering in this movie. Like just talking in shadows and stuff. And that's kind of cool too. Yeah. All right.
So, Inherent Vice is playing at a theater near you if you're listening to this in a timely fashion.
Yeah.
If not, why don't you go buy it on Blu-ray? Or if you're really far into the future, God knows, buy it on hologram disc.
Yes.
What do I know?
Yeah.
Or on vinyl.
I'm already dead at this point.
This is instantly one of my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movies. I mean... The Master, Aliens vs. Predator.
Soldier.
Dave, I think I'm going to have to check your internet history. You may have goofed.
Oh, wait, that's Paul W.S. Anderson. Yeah,
Event Horizon.
All right, so we're gonna move on from there? Anything else?
No, I think we did a very concise job. Good job, us. Everyone give yourself a pat on the back.
Oh, and Joanna Newsom, we talked about her. She's great.
I didn't know if we were going to be able to do it because the film is so convoluted, so dense, and so involved, so many characters, but I think I said all
funny.
I want to say.
Yeah, I think for three dum-dums, we did a pretty good job.
We all had cones on our head that said dunce on them.
We were all facing opposite directions as we did this.
So, let's recommend some movies.
All right.
Pick the movies. Pick the movies.
Oh, God, it never ends, does it?
I hope not.
11 more minutes.
11 more minutes!
Pick the movies.
My favorite part is how in time it is with the music.
Dave is known for his impeccable timing.
He's the human metronome, I believe they call him.
Oh, man.
God. All right.
Who would like to go first this week?
I'll go. Okay. Why not?
I like it.
Thanks. My pick is a film. It came out in 2014. And I wish I had seen it sooner because it would have made somewhere in my list of the best films of the year. Mm. And it is a documentary called Finding Vivian Mayer. And Dave reviewed it for the site cutprintfilm.com. And it's a true story, obviously, because it's a documentary. That was a stupid thing I just said. It's a documentary about this woman. She was a street photographer, and she took over 100,000 photos in her lifetime, and she never shared them, basically. She took them and never showed them to anyone. And she was basically just a mystery. No one really knew a lot about her. She sort of invented pasts for herself and lies for herself. And the documentary is about this guy. His name is John Maloof, and he was writing a history book about Chicago, and so he was buying photographs at auctions. And he ended up finding all these photos by her, and he sort of just... became like an amateur detective, just tracking down her life, finding out who she was. And it's such an engrossing movie. It's like a mystery, but it's a documentary, and you're hooked sort of right from the start, trying to.
It's absolutely fascinating.
It
this
is.
Film.
Yeah, just,
I loved it
right from the start. I was just like, wow, this is like I almost like wanted it to go on longer. I wanted to just keep.
I had that feeling too.
Keep digging into her past and all this stuff.
It's just like so many layers. Like on the one level, you have this guy finding this national treasure. Right. It's like this treasure trove of one of the greatest photographers in American history because these photographs are. Beautiful.
Oh, yeah. She's a master at photography.
These photos, I feel like even if you don't know anything about like photography and art, you just from like the way they're composed, you can tell like this is something special.
Yeah, it pulls something out of you.
She had this unique way of framing and light and capturing light, and I've heard people say like photography isn't an art, anyone can do it, and that's fucking bullshit because
the second you look at these
It's just it requires a certain skill that not everyone has, and she had it. And it just the fact that she never really showed it to anyone, it makes it sort of, you know.
Yeah, and then there's the whole mystery level where it's like, was she a spy? Was she just like a fucking lunatic? Like
the answer is surprising.
The answer will shock you. So
try this one weird trick and watch Finding Vivian Meyer.
So yeah, you can. I saw this on Showtime Anywhere. It's on their streaming service. So I'm
anywhere,
anywhere. It's anywhere you want to be. So
even in hell,
I hope so.
Even in the middle of a murder suicide.
So yeah, track it down. It's called Finding Vivian Meyer.
Mamma mia! So some species have got spicy meatballs, Jack.
What a dickhead.
You want me to go, Jeff?
I'll go.
Okay.
I think I went last week. I don't know. I won't dare do that again. my recommendation is a film from 2012. It is also a documentary.
Whoa.
It's called Radio Unnameable.
Hmm.
And it was directed by Paul Lovelace and Jessica Wolfson. You know, every time you get two directors involved in something, it's going to be something special.
Yeah, it's going to always work.
Every time. but this is a really interesting documentary. It's about legendary radio personality Bob Fass, who revolutionized late-night FM radio by serving as a cultural hub for music, politics, and taking audience phone calls for 50 years.
Is this the inspiration for the film Pirate Radio?
Oh, no, it's not.
That terrible film that
absolutely
no one saw?
Long before social media existed, Bob Fass utilized the airwaves for mobilization, encouraging people to organize and get together and be activists. Abbie Hoffman was a constant caller into his show, who created the Yippie movement, if you guys are familiar with that. And this is just a really cool documentary. Fass still is still alive. He's in it heavily.
He's very critical of LBJ at the time.
Yeah.
What I'm reading.
Yeah.
So that ties in.
He was very political. Very, very political. And he still he still has a show today on the same station, except he doesn't get paid.
What station? Is it Sirius?
It's kind of like us.
Is it Sirius FM?
It is not Sirius FM. I actually forget the call letters for this. It's a New York City station.
Is it WNBC?
But people are so enwrapped with this show that one guy 100 miles away manages to listen somehow. He has this signal booster that he hooks up to his car and then runs a wire from his car into his house so he can listen to it on the stereo and call into the show.
Oh my God.
He's got an incredibly rabid fan base long before like Howard Stern ever did anything like that. There's one sequence where a man calls into the show and he has taken sleeping pills and he's going to kill himself, and Fast keeps him on the line for 8 hours.
Wow.
Because that's how long it took to trace the phone call, because it was old school operators. So the operator would have to plug into every single circuit on every single board.
Oh my God.
To find out where this person was. It's an absolutely fascinating documentary. It's on Netflix. It's called Radio Unnameable.
Nice.
Mamma mia, that's a spicy meatball.
Guys, guess what just happened?
I don't know.
It's a doc block.
Oh. 12-hour doc block coming at you.
I am going to recommend Werner Herzog's.
Stop right now.
Boy, I'd like to rip your larynx out.
Don't make me get my giant clown mallet out, I swear. I will bonk you on the head.
This is a film that I brought up earlier in the week to you guys. 2011's Into the Abyss.
A lighthearted romp, yes. I believe this film is.
It's a date movie.
Subtitled, A Tale of Death, A Tale of Life. That's my
You're the worst.
I was better earlier before the show, but...
Don't let him fool you, folks. It was just as bad.
It was literally the same.
This movie is chilling. And it's a kind of a dismantling of the justice system's... what's that called? Capital punishment?
Yeah.
When they write your name in all capital letters and put you in a cell.
I think you're mistaken.
No, so he takes this case, which is basically these two junkies want this red car, so they go to this guy's house who they knew had a red car, and they shoot his mother while she's baking cookies. Like he picks the most brutal murder, and then shows you why these people shouldn't be condemned to death. Like, and I felt like that was so smart, and it kind of changed my opinion on the death penalty, because I'm usually all for it because I'm a reactionary,
and you don't value life.
Yeah, and I'm an eye for an eyeist, but this movie is just chilling. It will haunt you in more ways than one.
It's such a senseless murder. It's like the epitome of the type of murder where you're just like, they should kill those assholes, and it is a genius way of deconstructing that.
It's the kind of movie that'll make you go buy a gun, because you'll be like, oh, this could have just happened to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I went and bought a gun. Oh, 17 of them.
I heard Jane got a gun too.
No wonder you've been polishing that the whole show.
There's not much more I can say about it other than it's chilling, and it's a documentary worth watching. Better than the other two recommended tonight, so watch this one first.
My favorite part of Into the Abyss is when Ed Harris sees the water alien come out.
Chris, I think you've goofed. I think we're talking about different films.
Oh, no, this isn't the James Cameron one?
No.
With the water aliens?
All right.
So what was that called again?
Into the Abyss.
All right.
A Tale of Life, A Tale of Death.
Well, we've all agreed, and Dave will get the death penalty after his terrible impressions.
I've been keeping them bottled up for a while.
That's true. It has been a while.
I did a Martin Luther King and a Werner Herzog in the same show.
Wow.
And neither of them were any good.
That's why you're going to jail.
So we loved Inherent Vice.
Yeah.
My advice would be to go to the 10 a.m. showing, walk out, buy a hot dog, go right back in.
Well, I don't know why.
Nothing says delicious like a movie theater hot dog.
Sitting out all day on the rack.
I also want to say you should go see Selma, ASAP, because that is a fantastic film.
It's an important movie.
Yes, it is.
So you should see it. So what do we got? What are we
cooking? What's in the cooker?
All right, in the cooker for next week, or this week, if you will, over at cutprintfilm.com, is you're going to find reviews for Black Hat.
Oh.
That's the movie about a hacker who does push-ups and bicycle crunches.
Yeah, so you know he's serious.
Chris Hemsworth stars.
Yes.
Also, my review for Paddington will be out.
I hear it's good. Is it good?
You'll have to go to cutprintfilm.com to find out.
Is that Paddington J. Bear?
There's no J. also, you'll see reviews for Still Alice and Little Accidents and several other films.
Yeah,
and that you've never heard of before.
And there might be some editorials popping up. Who knows?
Who knows?
We know
because we're the editors, but we shan't tell you now.
Yeah, because we're jerks.
You can also go to joystickjerks.com, and that is where you can find the Joystick Jerks podcast, where they talk about video games. It's basically like going to a party and somebody steals your girlfriend.
Wow.
So everybody should go over there and check out Joystick Jerks. Who else should you check out, Dave?
Antifanboy.com.
And what do they do?
Which is a video game podcast.
Oh.
So it's like going to your friend's house and watching them play video games.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay, perfect.
And then they steal your girlfriend.
Oh, all right.
Speaking of video games, our good friend Devin from Antifanboy is on yet another video game podcast. It's called Press Square, I believe.
Yes, it's a PlayStation podcast.
Oh, is that what it's about?
Yeah.
Okay.
So these guys won't steal your girlfriend.
I hope not. So yeah, go to them, look them up. And then, as always, we urge you to go to cutprintfilm.com, look us up on Twitter, look us up on Facebook, or even on Tumblr if you're into that.
We are. We'll tumble for you, as I like to say.
Yeah.
And
let us do the tumbling.
Yeah, we don't want you to hurt yourself.
Yeah, or at least wear some knee pads if you're going to tumble.
We're professionals. But yeah, as Chris said, you can find us on Twitter, @cutprintfilm.
Yeah, and I haven't plugged this in a while, but I have a book. It's called The House on Creep Street. Look it up on Amazon.
And if you need us tonight, we're going to be watching the Golden Globes.
No, we're not.
No. We're going to be rooting for all those sparkling movie stars to get those awards.
I hear I. Frankenstein's going to win it all, every category.